Hello, this is John Ivey from the Triangle Radio Reading Service. For the next half hour, I shall be reading to you from Boys Life magazine. The content of this program is intended for a print and visually impaired audience. Today we're going to begin with Scouts in Action. That's found on page 40 and 42. First one is, as Chance Vorpagel, 15, and Robert Fox, 13, were wrapping up a scout caving trip in Cairo, Georgia, a man in a state of panic approached them and asked for help rescuing his son. The boys calmed the man down, gathered their rescue gear, and went to the cave where they found Chance's father already comforting an exhausted, frightened boy who was too tired to climb up the rock face. Chance and Robert rigged a rescue pulley system and lowered it into the cave to raise the boy. The boy's father grew more and more anxious, even endangering himself by wandering too close to the edge, but Chance and Robert kept him calm throughout the ordeal. They lifted the boy 50 feet past a waterfall and out of the cave. One of the other cavers thanked Chance, Robert, and Mr. Vorpagel as everyone left for home. No one was hurt during the incident. Star Scout Chancellor Scott Vorpagel Top and Life Scout Robert Calvin Fox, members of Troop 173, chartered to the First United Methodist Church, Jupiter, Florida, each received a heroism award for his actions. And in the pictures, it shows how the man is running up to them in a panic, and the boys look at the cave, then has another picture tying the pulley around one of the boys, lowering them down, and then lifting the boy up. And then, of course, the picture of them receiving their medals. Good job, boys. Our next Scouts in Action is They Saved the Man After a Seizure. Hunter Jolly, 10, and Wesley Scoggin, 11, were fishing on a family camping trip near Clinton, Illinois, when their neighbor, Art Coakley, suffered an epileptic seizure and fell into the water. And it has a picture of the man slipping into the water. Well, the boys kept Mr. Oakley from going under. Hunter tried to grab Mr. Oakley's cell phone to call for help, but touching it gave him a shock. Wesley's dad heard the boys yelling and ran to the dock. A bystander, Mr. Scoggin, lifted Mr. Oakley out of the water. The seizure passed, and no one was hurt in the incident. Weblo Scouts Hunter Jolly Top and Wesley Scoggin, both members of PAC 142, chartered to the Catholic Men's Group, Clinton, Illinois, each received a heroism award for his actions. And here in the picture, it shows them lifting the man out of the water, both boys, and then getting him to safety. And, of course, there the picture of both the boys receiving their heroism award. And finally, he saved them from drowning. William Gonzalez Sierra, 13, his parents and their neighbors were on a day trip to Jayalla, Puerto Rico, when their neighbor's daughter fell into a river. The mother panicked and jumped into the water after her child. But William's neighbors couldn't swim, so William dived in and kept their heads above water. William pushed his neighbors closer to his dad so he could help hold them up. Bystanders helped the Gonzalez's bring everyone out of the water. No one was hurt during the incident. Second-class scout William David Gonzalez Sierra, a member of Troop 808, chartered to Double C Construction, Bayamon, Puerto Rico, received a heroism award for his actions. And, of course, the picture here shows them in the water, lifting them out to safety, and then, of course, William David receiving his heroism award. Well, excellent job, and good true stories about our scouts in action. We're going to follow that up with the Wacky Adventures of Pedro. Now, I have to remember, Pedro is a donkey and his two friends, Izzy and Frizzy. Well, it begins, even with his acutely accumulated wealth, Pedro's pals, Izzy and Frizzy, are audibly astonished at his avian assemblage. And he has a bunch of cartoon characters here, little birds. Well, Izzy says, "Wow, take a gander at all those artificial lawn birds." Then Frizzy, "With jewels, how could he afford all these?" Then Izzy says, "There he is. Let's ask him. Pedro, weren't all these bedeviled lawn birds expensive?" Pedro answers, "Just takes a little know-how, lads." Then Pedro says, "You see, I made some wise investments on the New York Stock Exchange." Oh, boy. And now let's find out about a little more about Pee-wee and his adventures in leadership. Now, if you know Pee-wee, is our cartoon character, and has him and Pee-wee and his two friends. And they say, "Okay, Pee-wee, what's all this about free leadership training?" "Yeah, what's in the box?" And it shows a big box here. And Pee-wee says, "I'm so glad you asked. Westy, you're in the right place if extreme high-quality leadership training is what you're after. And as for the box, rip, behold, Pee-wee's Instant Leadership Kit. Finally, the world will have access to my leadership brilliance. This kit contains everything the budding leader needs to get going." And it's your picture here of Pee-wee going into the box. And he pulls out his first thing, a distinguished hat to inspire confidence, a gray beard to denote experience, glasses to imply wisdom, and new shoes for dizzying authoritative height. And has Pee-wee on these stilts. And he's looking at his friends and says, "So, what do you think?" And his friends are just looking at him in a puzzled way. Pee-wee says, "I thought you might react this way, but I'm ready with a witty quote." And he begins to read from this book. "Any fool can criticize, condemn, and complain, and most fools do," from Ben Franklin. And then, as he's closing the book, he begins to fall. Whoa, 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 whoa. Down goes Pee-wee. And his friend says, as Pee-wee's lying on the ground with circles going around his head as if he may be unconscious, his friend says, "He also said, a man wrapped up in himself makes a very small bundle." Okay. We'll look forward to next time for Pee-wee's Adventures. Our next article, we have a picture here. The article is entitled Anthony's Ride, and it has a picture of a young man on a horse. It looks like he's on quite a gallop. Let's find out. He's just a stable hand, not a rider. How is Anthony going to make the Pony Express's most important mail run? There's nothing to it. The horses do all the work. The words Ian Roundtree once told him rang through Anthony Benton's head. So many dust-clouded miles, so many bone-jarring hours later, as the bay horse carried him across an endless prairie of sagebrush. His thighs felt raw while the wind blasted his numb face. His eyes burned, sand-coated his tongue. It even hurt to swallow. Every bone, every organ inside his body seemed to have been rattled loose. He wanted to stop, to sleep, yet he kept riding. He ought to be feeding horses or mucking stables, not risking his life to deliver letters to people he didn't know, mailed by people he had never met. This was Ian Roundtree's job, but Ian had broken his leg 2 days earlier. Mr. Kruger, the station master, didn't worry. Jules Cook could fill in, and when a high fever kept Jules in bed, Mr. Kruger merely said, "Coop Richardson will just have to ride to the next station." Only when Coop Richardson galloped to Midway Station just before dawn, he collapsed from the saddle, clutching his stomach. "Drank bad water," pain racked Coop's voice. "Sick." Anthony had been holding the rein to the fresh horse. He constantly marveled at how fast those riders, many no older than he was, could exchange a 20-pound mail sack called a mochila from one saddle to another. Midway was a home station where a new rider was supposed to take over. But at relay stations, the rider would leap on a new horse with the mochila and disappear, often without a chance to say hello or goodbye. Mr. Kruger was already putting the mail on the fresh horse, yelling at Anthony, "Get on, kid! You got to make this ride!" But, Anthony tried to say, But Mitchell Krueger lifted Anthony's leg, guided his foot into a stirrup, and shoved him onto the eager-to-run black horse. "No choice," Mr. Krueger shouted. "Just get to the relay station. Somebody can take over there." Mr. Krueger slapped the horse's rump, and Anthony almost fell off immediately. The burst of speed shocked him as much as being in the saddle. His hat blew off. He didn't try to catch it, just gripped the reins. Oh, Anthony could ride. Practically every 14-year-old boy in Nebraska territory knew how to ride. The Central Overland California and Pikes Peak Express Company, commonly called the Pony Express, had hired him because he knew horses. But he was a stable hand, not a rider. "This is our most important run ever," Mr. Krueger yelled. "It's in our hands." 10 miles. Anthony could stay on a galloping horse for that long. "Just follow the river. Keep your balance. Do as Ian told you. Let the horse do all the work." 10 miles. But the man at Gilman Station didn't give him a chance to explain. Just helped him off one horse and onto another. And he was back in the saddle, riding west, always already aching. 3 horses later, he dashed toward Fremont Springs, knowing he'd find a new rider at home station, could climb out of the saddle and collapse. Yet as he neared the station, a bearded man waved his hat frantically, and Anthony realized there were no horses, none, and no new rider to relieve him. "Stock's been run off," the man yelled. "Keep riding, keep riding." Anthony didn't have time to think. He kicked the horse's ribs and loped back to the trail, riding on and on, watching out for Indians. Said the boy holding a fresh horse at Fallon's Bluff, "Watch out for Indians." "Indians?" For 5 miles, Anthony scanned the horizon. In addition to the mochila, riders carried water and a revolver. That was all. But Anthony wasn't a regular rider. He wore no gun. What would he do if he ran into a bunch of Indians? Slowly, he relaxed. Maybe the boy had been teasing him. And it has a picture here of Anthony actually doing the loping. Anthony eased into a trot, then started loping, riding straight for those 20 Indians. Then he saw the brave mounted on a horse 200 yards off the trail. Gripping a lance in his right hand, fear gripped Anthony as the Indian turned his horse and began loping west. Although he kept his distance, the Indian was definitely following him. "It's not my mail," Anthony thought. "I'll quit. Next station, I'll just get off this horse and quit." He didn't, though. He couldn't. "This is our most important run ever," Mr. Krueger had said. Sure, Mr. Krueger had told every rider that same very thing, every time in every run. It didn't mean anything. "But he said that to me," Anthony said. "Me. It's in my hand." Before he reached the next station, the Indian vanished. Yet after Anthony had changed mounts and covered another mile, the Indian was back, following him, a little closer now. So it went. The Indian would fade into the sagebrush when Anthony neared a relay station, then reappear on the westward trail. Since Franz's station, where he had picked up the bay horse, he hadn't seen the Indian. Probably got bored, he thought. But now Anthony faced a new problem. The trail was washed out. He'd have to ease his horse into a gully, climb out of the other side. He could do that, just lean back in the saddle, give the bay plenty of rein. They were halfway down when the horse stumbled. Quickly, Anthony kicked his feet from the stirrups, felt himself catapulted. He hit hard, sagebrush slashing his arms and face, sand scraping his palms. Groaning, Anthony stumbled to his feet. The horse rolled over, snorted, and rose as Anthony quickly caught the reins. "Easy, boy," he whispered. Kneeling, he checked the bay's legs and sighed with relief. Bleeding and bruised, just like Anthony, but nothing broken. They could make it to Julesburg, only a mile or so away. After leading the horse out of the gully, he swung back into the saddle and saw the Indian. This time, the brave wasn't alone. Anthony nudged the bay into a walk, making sure the horse was all right. He eased into a trot, then started loping, riding straight for those 20 Indians. He didn't know what tribe blocking the trail. Turn back? No, he wouldn't do that. Besides, he couldn't outrun them, not on this horse. Probably not on any horse. He galloped toward them, closer. Anthony closed his eyes. Hearing the yells, he opened his eyes to find the Indians moving out of his way, lifting lances and bows over their heads, cheering him, honoring him, saluting his bravery. Stunned, he thundered past them toward the sinking sun. Ahead of him lay Julesburg Station. He saw a rider and horse ready to take the Mochilla. Anthony had done it. He had covered 150 miles, twice the distance of a normal run. Everybody would ask how a stable hand had been able to make such a hard ride. As the bay carried him the last few yards, Anthony found his answer. There's nothing to it. The horse does all the work. The real story of the Pony Express. On April 3, 1860, a rider left St. Joseph, Missouri, heading west, while another departed Sacramento, California, heading east. The Pony Express was off at a gallop to deliver mail in 10 days or less. 10 days seems like a long time now, but cars hadn't been invented and railroads wouldn't connect the east and west coasts until 1869. The Pony Express used relays of riders to carry mail across 2,000 miles of often treacherous country. In 1861, completion of the telegraph line allowed for direct communication between New York and San Francisco. That put the Pony Express out of business only 18 months after it started, but not before its daring riders earned their place in history. Today, the Pony Express National Historic Trail covers almost 1,900 miles across 8 states along the route. Good article. Well, let's now talk about one of my favorites, golfing. Page 37 to 39. Here on page 37, it has a picture of a young golfer, Justin Thomas. Let's read his profile. Justin was born April 29, 1993. His hometown, Goshen, Kentucky. His biggest wins, 2009 AJGA FootJoy Invitational, in 2009, and in 2008, AJGA Natural Resources Partners Bluegrass Junior, in 2009, Kentucky High School State Championship, individual and team. His favorite course, Victoria National in Newburgh, Indiana. Every shot tests you. There are deep bunkers, high grass and water everywhere, and the greens are extremely fast and severe. Started playing. At 18 months old, his dad, teaching pro Mike, sawed off a fairway wood and they would play when few people were around. They ran after balls, hit goofy shots, threw balls onto the green. He wanted to equate being on the golf course with fun, Mike says. Well, why golf? Unlike team sports, you are in control of your destiny. It's all on you. If you have a bad day, you're the only one to blame, and it pushes you to get even better. The future? Justin wants to turn pro after college. Article is entitled, Go Golfing. In August 2009, 16-year-old Justin Thomas became the third youngest player to make the cut at a Professional Golfers Association tournament. That meant he beat nearly 70 pro golfers, all older and more experienced. Justin qualified for his first tour event by winning the 2009 American Junior Golf Association FootJoy Invitational. Since he's still an amateur, Justin can't keep prize money, but the experience left him richer in another way. It really gave me a lot of confidence that I could play with those guys, he says. It's a matter of who putts and who chips the best. Boys Life talked with Justin to get his tips on playing golf. His first tip, number one, the drive. It's cool to hit it far, but it's better to hit it straight. Start with your grip. Place all your fingers around the club with your thumb staying on the top. Keep the club in your fingers rather than in your palm and grip lightly. Then comes the stance. Place your feet shoulder-width apart and line up the ball with the inside heel of your front foot. Swing back by turning your shoulders and hips away from the target, keeping your head still. Start the swing back to the ball by turning your hips toward the target as you swing through. Your hand should finish over your shoulder on the follow-through. And, of course, it has a picture of Jason demonstrating the stance, the grip, and the swing for the driver. Number two, the irons. Use a hybrid club instead of a 3, 4, or 5 iron. Hybrids like the Titleist pictured below are much easier to hit. At your setup, place the ball halfway between the middle of your stance and the front foot. The shorter the club is, the higher its number, the farther back you want the ball, place the ball. But don't go farther back than halfway between your feet for full swings. Number 3, short game. That's chipping and putting. Practice it about 10 times more than you think you should. The stroke is similar for both. In putting, start with the ball just in front of mid-stance. Your backswing and follow-through should be equal distance. The longer the putt, the more backswing and follow-through. Number 4. Bunkers. Stand with the ball near the front of your stance, lining it up with the inside heel of your front foot. A lot of people are afraid of hitting out of the sand. Just take a full swing, aim an inch behind the ball. This is one of the rare cases in golf where you do not hit the ball first and follow through, so the sand helps hit the ball out of the bunker and helps lift the ball out of the bunker. Number 5. This is when you're off the green in about 40 to 100 yards and want to loft the ball high without too much roll. Stand with your feet closer than shoulder width, and so the ball is at the mid-stance. When you swing, think of a light karate chop down on the ball. Keep your hands ahead of the ball. Follow through with your arms, but not as far as a full swing with irons or woods. The ball should fly up, then almost stick on the green because of the backswing, because of the backspin. And of course, it has a picture here of Justin demonstrating the pitch shot. Number 6, routine. Having a pre-shot routine is important. With tee shots, chips, irons. 1. Take 2 or 3 practice swings. 2. Get 10 feet behind the ball and face the target. 3. Visualize the shot I want to hit. 4. Set up to the ball and hit it. On putts, after I read the green, I go 10 feet behind the ball facing the target and try to visualize the ball going in. Take 2 practice swings next to it, then hit. Number 7. General thoughts. Try not to think too much. The more things you think about, the worse you're probably going to hit. Aim for the fairway. When I'm on the practice tee, I try to invent competition scenarios so I'm not just hitting as hard as I can. If there are flags or trees, I use them as targets. I say to myself, this is the right side of the fairway. This is the left. You practice how you play. Commit to the shot you want to hit. Don't second-guess yourself. And finally, number 8, attitude. Everyone struggles at some point with something. Earlier in high school, if I had a bad hole, I'd think negatively, and it would keep getting worse and worse. You have to realize that the best players in the world have bad days. You want those bad days to be as good as possible. Sometimes the weather makes it hard to play. You can't let the conditions get to your head. Understand that sometimes par is a good score. Sometimes bogey is too. If you want to be the best, learn to accept those kinds of things. Be patient. Be confident. Practice as much as you can. And, of course, it has Justin demonstrating all of the shots along with going through his routine. These thoughts from a great player can help you get started in the game of golf. Also, consider taking lessons from local PGA professionals at a course near you. Let's go to the Bible story, page 45. Upon his return to Egypt, Moses went to confront Pharaoh and his brother Aaron. But Pharaoh ignored Moses and Aaron's plea to let Israel worship the Lord. Instead, Pharaoh increased the labor of the Hebrew slaves. Now Moses became filled with doubt, saying, "Look at me, Lord. I stutter. No wonder Pharaoh will not listen to me." Moses believed that he had only brought more trouble upon his people. Then the Lord reassured him, saying, "Even if I fill Egypt with signs and wonders, he will not listen to you. The Egyptians will realize that I am truly God when I step and deliver Israel out of this land." And here is a picture with Moses and his brother Aaron with them. And Moses talking to Pharaoh, and he says, "This is what the Lord, the God of Israel, says. Let my people go, that they may worship me. Our God has met with us. Let us depart, that we may hold a festival to him." And Pharaoh, with his hands up in a stop fashion towards Moses, says, "Who is the Lord that I should obey his voice and let Israel go? Now get back to work." That's the end of the article. Now at 55, think and grin. Someone pleasant to be around. Abhinav Jadawa from Fremont, California. "Lucas, why did the spider take swimming lessons?" Will: "I don't know. Why?" Lucas: "He wanted to surf the web." That's from Lucas Maley in Manhasset, New York. Noah: "What do you call a happy citizen of Istanbul?" Alex: "I don't know." Noah: "A Turkish delight." From Noah Huntley in Green Bay, Wisconsin. Simon: "Why did the orange go to the hospital?" Ted: "I haven't a clue." Simon: "Because it wasn't peeling well." Simon Zofler in Riyadh, Saudi Arabia. Chris: "Where do cowboys go to think?" Duncan: "I don't know." Chris: "The Ponderosa." Chris: "Which baseball player holds water?" John: "I don't know which one." Chris: "The pitcher." A cruise ship passes by a remote island, and the passengers see a bearded man running around and waving his arms wildly. "Captain," one of the passengers asks, "who is that man over there?" "I have no idea," the captain says, "but he goes nuts every year when we pass him." That's from Yoji Mikamura from Cheswick, Pennsylvania. Teacher: "Johnny, why is the Mississippi such an unusual river?" Johnny: "Because it has four eyes but can't see." And that's from George Iskander from Bayonne, New Jersey. Warped wise man wonders, "If the cost of feathers is rising, does that mean down is up?" From Kenneth Dobis from Las Vegas, Nevada. Tim: "What does a frog use to keep away burglars?" Tom: "I have no idea." "A lily padlock." And that's from Adam Wolf in Westchester, Pennsylvania. James: "What material makes the best kites?" Pedro: "Tell me." James: "Fly paper." Okay. That's from James Lynn in Camarillo, California. James: "When is a door not a door?" Shane: "When?" James: "When it's ajar." Okay. And that's from James Lynn in Camarillo, California. Joe: "What do you call a reptile that goes undercover?" Billy: "I don't know." Joe: "An investigator." And that's from Neil Barnard in Hartville, Ohio. Pat: "What's the difference between a pirate and a cranberry farmer?" Jerry: "I don't know. What?" Pat: "A pirate buries his treasure, but a cranberry farmer treasures his berries." And that's from Patricia Johnson in Warrens, Wisconsin. And finally, Sam: "Why does a chicken coop have two doors?" Danny: "Why?" "Well, if it had four, it would be a chicken sedan." And that's from Samuel Nielsen in Gig Harbor, Washington. Well, that's about all we have time for today's episode of Voice Life. Be sure to listen next time. We hope you've enjoyed it. I'm John Ivey, reading for the Triangle Radio Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for a print and visually impaired audience. So long, till next time.